The Nanking Massacre is going to be remembered not only for the number of people slaughtered during this siege, but for the cruel and sadistic manner many innocent civilians met their deaths. Chinese men met the devil in the hands of their oppressors, as they were subjected to unimaginable horrors. Some were used as bayonet practice, while others were used as props for decapitation contests. Chinese women experienced their own horrors, as of all 80,000 women were marched straight to hell. It's estimated that up to 80,000 women were raped, with many being disemboweled during. Some had their breasts sliced off, while the unlucky ones were nailed alive to the walls of their homes after. The devil made Nanking his home, as fathers were forced to rape their daughters, sons their mothers, as their own family watched. The sounds of live burials, the screams coming from men being castrated in public, echoed through all of Nanking. Organs were carved and people were burned alive in such numbers that it was almost a routine. One could not walk from house to house without seeing friends and family hanging by their tongues on iron hooks, or seeing them be buried from the waist down as German shepherds were unleashed to tear them apart. The Japanese took depravity to new depths, that Nazis were sickened at what they were seeing. Horrified, one Nazi official described what was going on in Nanking as bestial machinery. And it was in 1937 that, after their successful invasion of Shanghai, that the Japanese decided to attack the newly appointed capital of the Republic of China. The Chinese city of Nanking fell on December 13, 1937, to the Japanese, who immediately started their orgy of cruelty, one so foul that it's not been replicated since. On that night, tens of thousands of young men were rounded up outside the city, only to be met with waves of machine gun fire and drenched with gasoline, only to be lit up and burned alive. 4 weeks, the once beautiful city of Nanking was now littered with corpses, burnt and mauled, while the stench of death and rot burned the nostrils. It's estimated that more than 250,000 non-combatants died in the hands of the Japanese that occupied just this one city. And to put those numbers into perspective, if the dead from Nanking were to link hands, they would stretch for 200 miles. Their blood would weigh 1,200 tons, and it would take almost 3,000 railroad cars to accommodate all the corpses. And if you stacked all the bodies atop one another, you would get a 74-story tower of death and macabre. Both world wars saw unimaginable atrocities, but not in the scale of Nanking. Hitler and Stalin did both murder in the millions, but it took them years to do so. Nanking was a concentrated effort, whose death toll exceeded the number of some European countries for the entire war. So let's sit back and learn about the forgotten Holocaust of World War II.
He's talking and I'm not, and I'm just and then I'm
no, but wait, I have something for him.
Boom. Yeah. get shot down.
Now you're just fucking me, aren't you?
I'm just wondering why all these people like kids.
The Weird History and Eerie Tales Podcast.
Concentrating on the dude. It's what we do.
Wow.
FY, there's nothing wrong.
And welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Weird History Eerie Tales Podcast. I am your host, Moses Soria, and sitting in front of me is my brother, Josh.
Yo, what's good?
And today, we're going to be talking about the brutal, brutal occupation and destruction of the Chinese imperial city of Nanking.
It's a sad, sad story.
It's
jokes or no jokes? You think we're going to do any jokes? Right now, I'm saying no.
There's no room. There's no. If there are jokes, it's not at the expense of what's happening, but only to try and lighten up the mood of what is going on. Because, god damn. My source for this whole series, The Rape of Nanking, The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II, written by Iris Chang. This series is only going to focus on the massacre of Nanking. This book, The Rape of Nanking, deals with the leading up to, including the 6 week of horror that we're going to talk about as the rape of Nanking, plus what happens in the aftermath of Nanking. This is a, I don't want to say beautiful book, because of what it's about, but it's beautifully written and it's very respectful. But if you guys can, please get this book if you just want to know the whole story of Nanking, about the Japanese occupation of this Chinese city. Because we're only going to focus on the actual brutality of the occupation of Nanking, because if not, this will be a multi-part, very deep dived episodes. So we're not going to do that. This is going to be just a 3-part series on the massacre, about the forgotten Holocaust of World War II, which is the Nanking massacre.
Nanking.
If you guys want to know more about the book, or if you guys want to buy the book, you guys just check out the episode show notes. You guys can find the Amazon link, click on it and buy it. So please do yourself a favor. If you are squeamish, or if you do not like many of us, or if you can't stand the talk of infanticide, rape, this is very, very
dark as fuck.
Yes. All right. There you go. It's a dark.
It is gruesome. If you got a bitch stomach like myself.
Not even. If you just have a normal stomach, if you, like, this book, yeah,
fair,
so.
Fair.
Yeah, fair. So please do yourself a favor.
Skip.
In the summer of 1937, Japan had finally gotten the war with China they've been working towards. In July, during a night training in the Chinese city of Qinshin, a Japanese regiment, which was garrisoned in China by a treaty, were conducting night maneuvers near the ancient Marco Polo Bridge when several shots were fired at them in the dark. So when they retreated and a Japanese soldier failed to appear during roll call, the Japanese troops made their way to the Chinese fort of Wanpian and demanded that the Chinese fort open their gates so they could search for their soldier. When the Chinese commander refused, the Japanese attacked, escalating the matter to the point of no return. But soon, the Japanese would come to realize that conquering China would be a lot more difficult than they anticipated. A few years back, Japanese military leaders would brag and boast about how easy Japan would be able to conquer mainland China. They believed it would be such a piece of cake that they guaranteed it would take no more than 3 months.
Cocky much.
It is. And this is very reminiscent of the whole Russia-Ukraine thing, where Russia's like, this is a weekend thing. We could do this. Start Friday, Sunday. They're all Russians.
GG easy. That's what they said. That's what they thought. That's what they did.
But just like with the whole Russia-Ukraine thing, reality set in, and they realized how much more difficult it would be when one single Chinese city dragged out a battle from summer to fall and then to winter. Shattered were the egos of the Japanese military, and gone were their hopes of an easy victory, when simple Chinese men and women, devoid of any military knowledge, they were no Call of Duty enthusiasts, there were no FPS players, just farmers and wives, no training, and they managed to fight off the superior Japanese to a standstill. Again, very reminiscent of the whole Ukraine. Well, kind of, because technically we gave them all their arms, all their tanks and everything. Mm-hmm. But still, like, they still had to use the guns, you know what I mean? If someone had me a tank, I wouldn't know how to get in it, how to turn it on. But Shanghai eventually fell in November. But the mood of the Japanese army soured and turned ugly. And it was said that the Japanese army was frothing at the mouth for revenge as they made their way to Nanking. Fuck. The Japanese had it all figured out, and the strategy for Nanking was simple. So Nanking rested south of the Yangtze River that flowed north of the city and then to the east. So the Japanese would flank from the southwest and use the natural barrier of the river to complete the circle and encircle the capital, cutting off all escape. In late November, three Japanese troops rushed toward Nanking. One traveled west under the southern bank of the Yangtze River. These troops were led by Nakajima Kisago, an experienced intelligence officer for the Japanese army in France and later as chief of the Japanese secret police. Little has been said or written about Nakajima, but what has been said has not been nice.
Not good, not good.
Not good at all. David Bergamini, author of Japan's Imperial Conspiracy, had this to say about Nakajima.
He was a small Himmler of a man, a specialist in thought, intimidation, and torture.
None of those are good. Calling you Himmler, the guy who basically created the Holocaust?
Mm-hmm.
Horrible. Many described him a beast. Not Himmler, but Nakajima. Well, I mean Himmler too, but when they talked about Nakajima, they called him a beast, a violent man, and a sadist. A title befitting to a man who packed for his journey to Nanking. This is what he packed. The only thing he packed when they said you're going to Nanking: a special oil for burning bodies.
But
the second troop that rushed towards Nanking were moving west from Shanghai in a route south of the first troop. So General Matsui Iwane was the general in charge of the second unit, and by no means was he a man of impressive stature. This was kind of fucked up when reading about this general, about General Matsui. Everybody talked about how very how unscary this man was, how skinny he was. They're like, this guy was appearance zero.
Simple.
No intimidation.
Easy to draw.
Intimidation's negative. It's simple to draw.
Simple to draw.
Negative. Like, no one was scared of this man.
Background character.
Not a background character, as we're going to find out, because he's a general.
But he looks like a background
character. Nothing about him physically is impressive. He was a frail, slight, wiry man with a mustache as thin as him. He was a devout Buddhist from a scholarly family. His resume, though, made up for a small stature, for he was the commander-in-chief of the Japanese army for the entire Shanghai Nanking region. The third force of troops traveled further south than Matsui's men and swerved northwest toward Nanking. Leading this force was Lieutenant General Yaganawa Heisuke, a bald, short man Interestingly enough, many involved in the brutal occupation of Nanking, and I'm putting that extremely mildly when I'm saying brutal occupation. Everybody who was a top official during the Nanking massacre, their life during the invasion was riddled in mystery. And Lieutenant General Yanagawa, his life during the invasion was even more mysterious. It was more veiled and shrouded in mystery. The Lutsuo, originally, he was kicked out and expelled from his rank by the fascist crew that took over the Japanese military when he tried to stop them in 1932. But due to him overachieving and rising in the ranks once more after being demoted, he made himself back to Nanking, where the military withheld his name and photographs from all publication at the time. I don't know if this was happening because they were embarrassed of him. They're like, dude, we fired him and this motherfucker's back. So when he was seen out in public, nobody really knew who he was, except that he was the lieutenant general. Then who is he? I don't know. He's just a fucking general.
He's a small bald dude, bruh.
So slowly, but surely, this mysterious man became to be known as the Masked Shogun. So the path to Nanking was raided and pillaged. Tiny farm communities slaughtered, and even entire cities were razed to the ground. For example, the Chinese city of Suzhou, one of the oldest in China, was reduced to nothing but a mere shell of itself when the population of 350,000 was reduced to less than 500 after days and days and days of murder.
That's fucking insane. For 350,000 to less than 500 in a matter of days.
To give you an example of the brutality of the Japanese army, a British correspondent passed through the city 2 months after the Japanese and reported this.
There is hardly a building standing which has not had been swallowed by fire. Fuck. A smoldering ruin with deserted streets. The only living creatures wandering were the fat dogs which had been eating the corpses on the streets.
And this was a common thing that the Japanese did as they made their way through China. But the worst was still to come. On December 7th, as the Japanese were nearing the capital of Nanking, General Matsui had a tuberculosis flare-up, which was aided by the stress caused when Matsui's military power was taken away from him and given to a member of the imperial court just a few days before. Emperor Hirohito, he promoted Matsui out of power while replacing him with his uncle, Prince Osaka Sohiko. The power shift from Matsui to Prince Osaka, not only was it an important one, but it was also a weird one. No one really knows why this happened. Some think it had to do with the prince testing his uncle's loyalty, since he originally sided with the emperor's brother during the military coup. Another thing, which proved to be a critical point later on in the story, is that as a member of the royal family, remember, he is a prince, Osaka possessed power that would override everyone around him when it came to Nanking. Sure, the military had its chain of command, but all of that went out the window when it came to the prince. So Matsui recognized this, and before his official leave, he set a moral commandment for the invasion of Nanking. Matsui was not close with the prince, but he knew that the prince was closer to Lieutenant General Nagajima and General Yanagawa from their days in Paris, and figured that Osaka might use this chance as a way to redeem himself. So Matsui's like, all right, me and the prince, we don't really have a relationship, but the prince has a relationship with the two other generals. So if the two other generals, if they cozy up to the prince, The prince would give them unlimited power, and they're going to go fucking crazy. So to avoid any abuse of power, because remember, Matsui, he was in charge of everybody in Nanking.
Yep.
So even if the two other generals wanted to do something, they had to go to him.
Get the green light.
But if they wanted to do something, and they just went to the prince, and the prince said okay, they could just be like, the prince said it's cool. And if the prince is trying to prove himself, he's going to say yes to whatever the fuck they wanted.
Yep.
So Matsui, he recognized this. So he set a moral commandment for the invasion of Nanking. So to avoid any abuse of power, Matsui ordered armies to regroup a few kilometers outside the city walls to enter the Chinese capital with only a few well-disciplined battalions to occupy the city so that the Japanese army would sparkle before the eyes of the Chinese and have them place their trust and confidence in Japan. So he called a meeting of staff officers while sick in bed because of this tuberculosis flare-up, and this is what he proclaimed.
The entry of the Imperial Army into a foreign capital is a great event in our history, attracting attention of the world. Therefore, let no unit enter the city in a disorderly fashion. Let them know beforehand the matters to be remembered and the position of foreign rights and interests in the walled city. Let them be absolutely free from plunder. Dispose sentries as only needed. Plundering and causing fire, even carelessly, shall be punished severely. Together with the troops, let many military police and auxiliary military police enter the walled city and thereby prevent unlawful conduct.
Oh boy! Because Matsui knew, he's like
you. He knew. He's like, you guys, he knew these fuckers might, and sadly, did.
He
unlawful conduct.
Everything he said, this is what I want you to do. They did the fucking opposite. I want only a few sentries to go in. Wrong. Whole army. We have to be a shining example of greatness. We have to treat them with respect. Gone.
Did he say rape? I think he said rape.
Did he say no fires or all fires? But regardless of Matsui's efforts, horrible things were brewing. Man. On December 5th, allegedly, Prince Asaka left Tokyo by plane and arrived in China 3 days later in an abandoned villa a few miles from Nanking. It is here that the prince met with General Nakajima, a friend from Paris who was recovering from a wound in his left butt cheek. Nakajima told Asaka that the Japanese were about to surround 3,000 Chinese troops near Nanking and that the troops were ready to surrender. It is after hearing this report that from the prince's headquarters came out a set of orders under his personal seal marked
secret to be destroyed.
Years later, we found out what the clear message of those orders were.
Kill all captives.
We don't know if the prince himself issued those orders, but by the time Japanese troops entered Nanking, those orders had not only been committed to paper, but distributed amongst all low-level officers. December 13th, 1937, the Japanese 66th Battalion received the following command.
Battalion battle reporter, at 2 o'clock received order from the regiment commander. to comply with orders from Brigade Commanding Headquarters. All prisoners of war are to be executed. Method of execution. Divide the prisoners into groups of a dozen. Shoot to kill separately. 3:30 p.m., a meeting is called to gather company commanders to exchange opinions on how to dispose of POWs. From discussion, it is decided that the prisoners are to be divided evenly among each company, 1st, 2nd, and 4th company, and to be brought out from their imprisonment in groups of 50 to be executed. Man, 1st company is to take action in the grain field south of the garrison. 2nd company takes action in the depression southwest of the garrison. And the 4th company takes action in the grain field southeast of the garrison.
Believe it or not, there was logic behind this massacre. Heartless logic. The captives couldn't be fed, so they had to be destroyed. Killing them was the most brutal two birds, one stone analogy come to life I've heard in a long fucking time. Because in doing so, it eliminated any food problem that might arise, and two, because the less of them that are alive, the less of them willing to retaliate. But like dating single mothers and promising to yourself that this would be the last one, things are far easier said than done. Some of the Japanese troops smashed the city walls early in the morning of December 1st. They entered a city in which they were vastly outnumbered.
Which is insane to hear these numbers. And this is how much, 500,000 civilians. Okay, how much is 500,000?
500,000.
500,000 civilians and over 90,000 Chinese soldiers to the Japanese 50,000 that assaulted the city.
For every one Japanese soldier, there was two soldiers and maybe 20 civilians.
Now, do you think, obviously, we know the numbers now, right? Do you think they thought there was more?
I don't know. That's part of the whole thing with the whole Nank.
Of more of us.
Like, was it, what's like?
Psychologically, they were defeated. So they thought there was more.
To the Japanese, it would be far easier to mow down the crowds of thousands upon thousands upon thousands than to try and disarm them, or even let the Chinese civilians make any sort of trouble. The Japanese relied heavily on deception, considering they were vastly outnumbered. So in order to pull off this grand mass butchery, they had to first lie to the Chinese and promising them fair treatment in return for an end to their resistance.
That's fucked up.
Coaxing them into surrendering themselves to the Japanese conquerors, dividing them into groups of 100 to 200 men, and then luring them into different areas near Nanking to only be killed. And unfortunately to the Chinese, this was easier to pull off than the Japanese had hoped for. The resistance? Sporadic at best, in some areas, and almost non-existent in most, because many Chinese threw away their weapons as they tried to flee the city when the Japanese were closing in. And as for the soldiers, a lot of Chinese soldiers simply turned themselves in, hoping for better treatment. But as soon as they did, their hands were tied and bound. It's hard to really understand why the Chinese felt they needed to surrender so easily when they obviously had the upper hand when it came to the numbers, especially the soldiers. A Japanese soldier named Azuma Shiro described in his diary the easy surrender of thousands of Chinese soldiers shortly after the Japanese made their way inside the city walls. He and his troops were assigned sentry in the city square when they received an order to round up about 20,000 POWs. How big is this sentry? That's how we're gonna get the they were gonna go capture a group of POWs half the size of their army. So Azuma,
the fact that they just quit the second they entered the city wall, they're like, "All right, that's it, we're done.
All right, you guys got us." Yeah. So Azuma and his men walked until nightfall, over 10 miles in unknown territory, searching for these POWs, when they finally heard a rumbling noise coming from the bushes. As they made their way closer to the noise, they began to see numerous cigarette lights blink in the darkness. A little over 7,000 prisoners, all in one place, gathered around two white flags attached to a dead branch. Some covered their heads with blankets, others carried mat rush sacks, and some carried futons on their backs. This group of thousands of Chinese soldiers had waited patiently for the Japanese to round them and direct them to their next step of surrender. In his diary, Azuma wrote that it was a magnificent view seeing all those Chinese soldiers surrendered. He was also taken aback and quite stunned. Remember, this is a man who comes from a military culture where they give their pilots swords, not parachutes, where suicide is much preferred over surrender.
It was funny yet pitiful when I imagined how they gathered whatever white cloth that they could gather, attach it to a dead branch, and march forward to surrender. I thought, how could they become prisoners with the kind of numbers and force they had? More than two battalions, and without even trying to show any type of resistance. There must have been a considerable number of officers for this many troops, but not a single one remained. All of them having slipped away and escaped. Although we had two companies, and those 7,000 prisoners had already been disarmed, our troops could have been massacred if they just decided to rise up and revolt.
Without weapons, this fucking Chinese group of POW, this Chinese group of soldiers, still could have massacred the fuck out of the Japanese regiment that they surrendered to.
They were so scared then.
Nobody knows what it was.
Some black magic, some fucking...
Some say that the Chinese government, that the Nanking and a lot of cities felt betrayed by the Chinese government.
We'll side with them.
Fuck it. Oh. Our government, they betrayed us, so fuck them. Hey, you know what? We're good, bro. You know, I'm not going to die for these motherfuckers. I'm not going to die for this. Fuck that. I'm good. Here, I'm... Whatever you want.
Yeah.
Azuna felt sorry for the Chinese soldiers. Thirsty and frightened men who constantly asked for water and reassurance that they would not be killed.
Fuck.
But at the same time, their cowardice disgusted Azuma. He suddenly felt ashamed for ever having been secretly afraid of the Chinese in previous battles. His immediate impulse was to dehumanize the prisoners by comparing them to insects and animals.
And not only was Azuma disgusted, he had pity, right? And then to top that off with disgusted and then mad, the fact that he was fucking scared of these people. Oh boy, this is what Azuma had to say, right? They all walked in droves, like ants crawling on the ground. They looked like a bunch of homeless people with ignorant expressions on their faces. A herd of ignorant sheep with no rule or order marched on in darkness, whispering to each other. They hardly looked like the enemy who only yesterday was shooting and troubling us. It was impossible to believe that these were the same enemy soldiers. It felt quite foolish to think we had been fighting to the death against these ignorant slaves. And some of them were even 12 or 13 year old boys.
The Japanese led the prisoners to a nearby village. Azuma recalled that when some of the Chinese were herded into a large house, many of them hesitated to enter, many probably guessing they were entering into a Japanese slaughterhouse. The next morning, Azuma and his troop received orders to patrol another area in search of more POWs. Later that day, they learned that while they were away, the Chinese prisoners from the previous night were killed. Easily one of the single largest mass executions of POWs during the massacre of Nanking took place near Mufu Mountain, the mountain north of Nanking. An estimated 50,000 civilians and former soldiers were executed here. On December 16th, newspaper correspondent Yokoto reported that the Japanese had captured almost 15,000 soldiers near the artillery forts of Wulong and Mufu Mountains, and that the sheer number of prisoners was a huge problem. According to Kurihara Rishi, a former Japanese army corporal who kept diaries and notes of his time in Nanking, the Japanese disarmed thousands of prisoners, stripped them of everything except their clothes and blankets, and escorted them into temporary buildings. On December 7th, the Japanese received orders to kill the prisoners. So that morning, the Japanese announced to the Chinese that they were going to transport them to a small island in the middle of the Yangtze River. They explained to the Chinese that they needed to take special precautions for the move, so they bound their hands behind their back, a task that took almost all day. It wasn't until 6 p.m. that the Japanese divided the prisoners into four columns and marched them toward the riverbank.
After 3 or 4 hours of waiting, not knowing what was going on, the prisoners cannot see any preparations for crossing the river. It was then growing dark. They didn't know. They had no idea. Japanese soldiers had already encircled the prisoners in a crescent formation along the river and were in the sights of so many machine guns.
By the time the executions began, it was too late for the prisoners to escape.
Suddenly, all kinds of guns fired at once. The sounds of these firearms mingled with the desperate screaming and yelling of the Chinese.
For an hour, the Chinese struggled and thrashed around desperately to stay alive until there were few sounds coming from the group. From evening until dawn, the Japanese bayoneted the bodies, one by one. Getting rid of the bodies was a big problem for the Japanese as well. The Chinese killed by the Yangtze River were only a small fraction of the total deaths, and yet it took 3 whole days to clean that up. Burying the body was one method, but they quickly found out that it was hard to locate ditches large enough to bury over 7,000 bodies.
Oh, that's fucking insane, dude.
Cremation was another method thrown around to dispose of the bodies, but there was never enough fuel for it to really work right. They also tried burning them and turning them to ash, but with fuel being split with cremating them as well, the drums of gas ran out before the fires could reduce the bodies to ash. All in all, the result was mountains and mountains of charred corpses. But again, the soldiers weren't the only casualties of Nanking. The Japanese knew with all the Chinese soldiers either dead or surrendering, there was no one to protect the Chinese civilians, and knowing this, the Japanese soldiers stormed the city and swarmed every government building, bank, and warehouse, shooting everything in sight. They used machine guns, revolvers, and rifles. They shot at crowds of wounded soldiers, riddled elderly people, women and children with bullets. No street, no mud dugout, government building, city, square, alley, or ditch was safe from the Japanese. Nanking ran red with blood of the innocent on the night of December 13th, 1937. During the last 10 days of December, Japanese motorcycle brigades patrolled and guarded the entrances to all streets. Troops went from door to door, demanding for them to be open so that they can welcome the victorious soldiers. But as soon as the doors would open, bam, Japanese opened fire on them. The Japanese Imperial Army massacred thousands of people this way, and then looted the buildings and burned whatever they had no use for. To be fair, not all Japanese were joyously bathing in blood and high-fiving one another. Most were,
but not all.
But not all.
Fuck.
Japanese correspondents who had been following the troops were horrified at what they were seeing. Reporters watched as Japanese soldiers lined up Chinese prisoners on top of the wall near one of the city gates and charged at them. Bayonet first. Oof.
One by one, the prisoners fell down to the outside wall. Blood splattered everywhere. The chilling atmosphere made one's hair stand on end and limbs tremble with fear. I stood there at a total loss, not knowing what to do.
This reporter was not alone. In fact, almost all, even the seasoned war veteran correspondents, were horrified at what they were seeing, and they did not sugarcoat a thing when it came to putting their words to print. This is from Imai Masatake.
There was a dark silhouette of a mountain made of charred dead bodies. About 50 to 100 were dragging bodies from the mountain of corpses and throwing them into the river. They dripped with blood. Some of them were clearly still alive, moaning and groaning while their disfigured limbs twitched. The workers were too busy working in total silence, as in a pantomime. In the dark, one could barely see the opposite bank of the river. On the pier was a glistening mud under the moon's dim light. Took me a few moments to realize it was all blood. After a while, the Chinese had done their job of dragging corpses and the soldiers lined them up along the river, when suddenly the rapid fire machine gun was heard. The Chinese fell backwards into the river and were swallowed by the raging currents. A Japanese officer at the scene estimated that 20,000 Chinese had been executed.
From the Japanese military correspondent Omada Yukio, who saw Chinese prisoners lined up along the river.
Those in the first row were beheaded. Those in the second row were forced to dump the severed bodies into the river before they themselves were beheaded. The killing went on nonstop from morning until night, but they were only able to kill 2,000 Chinese this way. The next day, tired of killing in this fashion, they set up machine guns. Triggers were pulled and the prisoners fled into the water, but no one managed to make it across to the shore.
From Japanese photojournalist Kawano Hiroki.
Before the ceremony of entering the city, I saw 50 to 100 bodies floating down the Yangtze River. Did they die in battle? Were they killed after being taken prisoner? Were they slaughtered civilians? I remember there was a pond just outside of Nanking. It looked like a sea of blood, but with splendid colors. If only I had color film, what a shocking shot that would have been.
Women suffered the most when it came to the atrocities of Nanking. Coal trucks were sent out to collect women. No village or city street was safe. No matter how young or old, they would not escape the fate of being raped. With each woman signed to 15 to 20 soldiers for sex and abuse. Japanese veterans that survived the war claimed that the army had officially outlawed the rape of enemy women, but rape was a deep-rooted cancer in the Japanese military culture and superstition that not one soldier took it serious. Many soldiers believed that raping virgins made them stronger in battle, and that making amulets from the pubic hair of these victims would protect them from injury in battle. That's fucking ridiculous, bro. What the fuck? I can just imagine this dude with a necklace.
Fucking pubes.
Fucking pubes. The military policy that forbade the rape didn't really do so. It just encouraged soldiers to kill their victims afterwards. During an interview for the documentary, In the Name of the Emperor, Azuma spoke candidly about the process of rape and murder that took place in Nanking.
Chinese women didn't wear underpants. Instead, they wore trousers tied with a string, but as soon as the string was pulled, the buttocks was exposed. We would say things, "It's my turn to take a bath." And that meant it was my turn raping them. It would be all right if we raped them. I shouldn't say all right, but we always stabbed them and eventually killed them, because dead bodies never talk.
Here is Takakoro Kozo discussing the issue.
Fuck. Those women would start to flee once we let them go. Then we would just bang and shoot them in the back to finish them up. We felt a little bad when we raped them women because we looked at them as a woman right there. But when we killed them, we just thought of her as something like a pig.
Soldiers were not the only ones that took pleasure in the rape of these innocent women. Officers at all levels indulged as well. Dani Hasao, the senior general and commander of the Japanese 6th Division, who was found guilty of raping at least 20 women in Nanking, urged their soldiers to not only continue raping, but also warn them to get rid of the woman after they were done, as to eliminate the evidence of the crime.
That's fucked up. I mean, the whole thing's fucked up, but... man, reading it.
Your boss.
Oh, man. What do you do? Either pay them money or kill them in some out-of-the-way place after you have finished.
Luckily for the citizens of Nanking, the raping and killing stopped, even if it was for a brief moment. Matsui, who was still recovering, entered Nanking on the morning of December 17th for a ceremonial parade. He traveled up the Yangtze River on a naval launch and rode by car through the mountain gate on the east side of Nanking. There, he mounted a horse where he was wheeled to lead a parade. He went down several boulevards that were flanked with tens of thousands of soldiers, where he arrived at the Metropolitan Hotel in the northern part of town, where a banquet for Matsui was being held. But Matsui, he was no dummy. He not only knew that something was up, but that something was very fucking wrong. After the banquet, he called a staff conference and ordered all unnecessary troops to leave the city. The very next day, news outlets from around the world were reporting that the Japanese army was engaged in a huge conspiracy of silence against Matsui to prevent him from learning the full truth of what went down in Nanking. Matsui found out anyway. He learned of the full extent of the rape, murder, and looting of the city. He couldn't believe it, and he showed every emotion, from downright rage to gut-wrenching sadness.
And he knew this. He knew that
not only did he knew this was going to happen, he specifically said, "Don't do any of this." He lived word for word. Don't rape.
Don't burn.
Don't kill prisoners. Don't kill Chinese civilians. Only a few should come into the city, and those that are coming in have to be well obedient. And like, we have to be a shining example of fucking hope and gleam of a future.
And then the army was like, nah.
And this is what Matsui had to say. I now realize that we have unknowingly wrought a most grievous effect on this city. When I think of the feelings and sentiments of many of my Chinese friends who have fled from Nanking and of the future of our two countries, I cannot but feel depressed. I am very lonely and can never get in the mood to celebrate this victory.
Later that day, when the Japanese army held a burial service for all of their fallen soldiers, Matsui berated all 300 of his officers, commanders, and everyone else in a position of leadership for the despicable, obscene acts in the city. Correspondents reported that never before had a superior officer come down so hard on his officers. Everyone was shocked and in disbelief at Matsui's behavior because, lest we forget, one of the officers present was a prince of imperial descent.
Matsui didn't give a fuck.
He didn't give a fuck. Matsui was then put on a ship back to Shanghai, where he confided in the New York Times and told them that the Japanese army was probably the most undisciplined army in the world. But Matsui was not done bad-mouthing the Japanese army, because later in the month, he sent a message to Prince Asaka's staff, where he said the following.
It is rumored that unlawful acts continue, especially because Prince Asaka is our commander. Military discipline and morals must be more strictly restrained. Anyone who misconducts shall be severely punished.
He sent this to fucking Prince Asaka's staff saying, look, I know Prince Asaka's your boss, but we gotta do better. And remember, anyone who fucks up is gonna get it. So New Year's Day came and Matsui was still not done throwing shade. During a toast, he confided to a Japanese diplomat how the Japanese army was doing very bad things and wrong for doing so. But even with Matsui and his clear displeasure with the Japanese army, the raping and killing in Nanking persisted. Matsui claimed that he fell to his knees and wept in front of his soldiers when he first arrived in Nanking.
I immediately assembled the higher staff officers and wept tears of anger before them. Both Prince Asaka and Lieutenant General Yanagawa were there. I told them everything had been lost in one moment through the brutalities of the soldiers, and even then, they both laughed at me.
Those were Matsui's last words given to his Buddhist confessor right before his hanging in 1948. The Japanese soldier was primed and hardened to murder not only Chinese soldiers, but Chinese civilians as well. Numb to their basic human instinct to not harm or kill anyone who was not a threat, the Japanese had vicious games and exercises that they would partake in to pass the time. For example, on their way to Nanking, soldiers were having killing competitions, which was unfortunately covered by the Japanese media. Sometimes, as if they were sporting events, like the one for the December 7th issue of Japan Advertiser, with the headline reading,
Sub-Lieutenants in Race to Fell 100 Chinese Running Close Contest. Sub-Lieutenants Mukai, Takashi, Aki, and Noda, Takashi, in a friendly contest to see which one of them will first fell 100 Chinese individuals in sword combat before they occupy Nanking. Well into the final phase of the race, running almost neck to neck on Sunday, December 5th, the score, according to the army, was Mukai 89, Noda 78.
This was on a fucking Japanese newspaper. The score of a killing competition between two fucking Japanese lieutenants.
Before getting to Nanking.
A week later, the paper reported that neither man could decide who passed the 100 kill mark first. So they just said fuck it and increased the kill count to 150 kills.
Mukai's blade was slightly damaged in the competition, He explained that this was a result in cutting a Chinese in half, helmet and all. The contest was really fun, he declared.
You know who I picture saying this? Covering this? Like, he's them saying this?
Guy LaDouche?
Yes!
From MXC?
The contest was really fun, he declared. Like, I can just picture in his voice, Mukai's blade was slightly damaged in the competition. He explained that this was the result in cutting the Chinese in half, helmet and all. The contest was really fun, he declared.
He has a little pervy, high-pitched voice, dude.
And this was a common theme with the Japanese army. It's just that things took a turn for the worse in Nanking. But this is exactly what happens when you desensitize an army. One day, Second Lieutenant said to us, "You have never killed anyone yet, so today, we shall have some fun killing practice. You must not consider the Chinese as a human being, but only something of a rather less value than a street dog. Be brave. Now, those who wish to volunteer for killing practice, step forward."
No one moved. The lieutenant lost his temper.
"You cowards! Not one of you is fit to call himself a Japanese soldier. So no one will volunteer? Fine then."
He began to call us out by our names.
Otani, Furukawa, Tajima.
I raised my bayoneted gun with trembling hands and directed by the lieutenant's almost hysterical cursing. I walked slowly towards the terror-stricken Chinese soldier standing beside the grave he had helped to dig. In my heart, I begged his pardon, and with my eyes shut, the lieutenant cursing in my ears, I plunged the bayonet into the weeping Chinese man. When I opened my eyes, he had slumped down into the pit.
This was a natural impulse to the new soldier, but a memoir of a former Japanese warrior describes how a group of green Japanese recruits failed to hide their shock when they witnessed seasoned veteran soldiers torture a group of civilians to death. Their commander just laughed and shouted at them that they'll soon be doing the same thing. A veteran officer named Tomiga Shozo recalled his transformation from innocent youth to killing machine. He had been a fresh second lieutenant from a military academy when assigned to the 232nd Regiment of the 39th Division from Hiroshima. He claimed his superiors had evil eyes. Not eyes of humans, but the eyes of a leopard or tiger. On the front, Tomiga and other officers underwent intensive training, and during the program, an instructor pointed to a thin, emaciated Chinese man in the detention center and told the officers that he is the raw material for his trial of courage. Day after day, they were taught how to properly cut off heads and bayonet live prisoners.
On the final day, we were taken out to the site of our trial. 24 prisoners were squatting there with their hands tied behind their backs. They were all also blindfolded. A big hole had been dug 10 meters long, 2 meters wide, and more than 3 meters deep. The regimental commander, the battalion commanders, and the company commander all took the seats arranged for them. Commander Tanaka bowed to the commanders and began the trial by ordering a soldier to haul one of the prisoners to the edge of the pit. The prisoner was then kicked when he resisted. The soldiers finally dragged him over and forced him to his knees.
"Heads should be cut off like this,"
Tanaka instructed. He scooped water from a bucket and poured it over both sides of his blades. Swishing off the water, he raised his sword in a long arc. Standing behind the prisoner, Tanaka readied himself and cut off the man's head with a shout. The head flew more than a meter away. Blood spurted up in two fountains from the body and sprayed into the hole. I was so horrified, I couldn't breathe.
But that didn't last long. And as Tomiga learned to kill, he grew hungrier for it. And he no longer felt that his man had evil eyes.
Man, he was turned.
He was turned down bad.
Some Japanese soldiers admitted that it was pretty easy for them to kill, and it's easy to see why. Because they'd been taught that next to their emperor, everyone was valueless. The highest honor a Japanese soldier could have was die for their emperor. That was the greatest glory. If you watch any interview regarding Japanese soldiers during World War II, you'll hear over and over and over again that an enemy's life was less important than theirs. And theirs, according to their testimonies, was valueless to begin with. Japanese veterans from the Nanking Massacre have reported that they experienced a complete lack of remorse for what they did and had no sense of wrongdoing, even when it came to torturing helpless civilians. Nagatomi Hakudo spoke candidly about his emotions.
I remember being driven in a truck along a path that had been cleared through piles of thousands and thousands of slaughtered bodies. Wild dogs were gnawing at the dead flesh as we stopped and pulled a group of Chinese prisoners out of the back. Then the Japanese officer proposed a test of my courage. He unsheathed his sword, spat on it, and with a sudden, mighty swing, he brought it down on the neck of a young Chinese boy cowering before us. The head was cut clean off and tumbled away on the group as the boy slumped forward. The officer told me to take the head home as a souvenir. I remember smiling proudly as I took his sword and began to kill the other children.
60 years later, and after decades of soul searching, Nagatomi claims he's a changed man. Now a doctor in Japan, he has built a shrine of remorse in his waiting room, where patients can watch videotapes of his trial in Nanking, where he fully confesses to his crimes. Now, a gentle, hospitable old man, the doctor is disgusted and disapproves of the horrors of his past, making it almost impossible for one to not only imagine, but believe that this man was once a ruthless murderer. And that is where we'll end part one of our Nanking series. The next episode, we're going to get into the nitty gritty when it comes to the murders and the rapes and all of that. But I still, this episode, I still can't fathom, like, why didn't the Chinese just go for it? Go for it. And we're going to find out in the next episode, a little spoiler alert, that the only people that fucking gave the Japanese any trouble were moms or pregnant women.
Protecting there.
Those were the only ones that gave the Japanese soldiers any trouble or any tiffs. The men stayed quiet, accepted the fate. Fuck it, I'm gonna die. The women, nope. If I'm gonna die, I'm gonna try to bring your ass with me. I'm bringing one of you motherfuckers with me. Yeah, man, it's fucking this goddamn story, not story, but this fucking book, man, this whole chapter of like the forgotten Holocaust of the World War II. When you think of World War II, what do you think of? Either Pearl Harbor or the Holocaust.
Yep.
And there's so many other brutalities that came along with everything. And this is one of the ones that just fucking least talked about.
And which should be.
Which is fucking.
Which is insane.
I guess it's less talked about over here because it has nothing to do with us. You know, it wasn't no Americans.
True.
Obviously, there's some like racial overtones of why it's not like talked about over here. And that's why Iris Chang, right? That's why she wrote this book. And it's a New York Times bestseller. Just, it's an amazing fucking book. You guys should go out and get it. Click on the episode show notes. And one of the craziest things about this, the Rape of Nanking, is, and I've talked about it before, my buddy John, who made the podcast's first shirts, his dad survived this Nanking. His dad was in the city during the Nanking Massacre.
That's so fucking
And he said that his dad and a few of other children, they stayed alive because they found a ditch underneath like a street. And they hid there for 9 days, drinking and just eating trash.
Is his dad
still alive? From what I remember, his dad is still alive. This was a few... I've lost complete contact with him since... Because I used to work with him. And that was like fucking 3 jobs ago. Last time I spoke to him, he was going to move to Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he's like, dude, I'm tired of California. Too much taxes. I can't... He's a gun guy, you know?
Oh, yeah. So he's fucking...
He's like, I'm done. He's super chill. He's like, dude, I just want to drink beer, fix my bikes, and hang out with my girlfriend. That's it.
Wait, was he the one that his dad owns the liquor store?
That was his family's business when they were here. Oh, okay. Yeah, that was his. Yeah, cool dude. But yeah, man, it's fucking crazy. This whole episode is crazy, man. So one of the things I wanted to talk about is obviously you noticed Archie's not here.
Uh-oh.
Because fuck that guy. Not just playing.
Where's Archie?
Moving forward, when we're doing multiple series episodes, it's just going to be my brother because it's easier for us to plan this out. And it gives Archie a little break for him to catch up and do what he needs to do. So when it comes to like big series episodes, it's just going to be me and my brother. Maybe once in a while, it'll probably be me and Archie, where my brother can, if he needs to sit out or whatever. But for the most part, it's just going to be, you know, me and my brother for these long, multi-part episodes. Yeah, man, I hope you guys enjoyed this. Join us next episode where we're gonna get into the real nitty gritty and get real fucking knee deep in blood and guts and everything wrong with the fucking world.
So if you were sad with this episode,
this was a pregame. This was a pregame. Damn.
Brace yourselves.
So I hope you guys enjoyed. Thank you guys. Please add us on Instagram if you haven't already. Weird History Eerie Tales Pod. Please rate and review us. Again, please buy this book. But buy it after you listen to this series. You know, because we're skipping a lot. One of the things that I'm not talking about, just because I feel it derails a little bit from the topic, is how Japan kind of started a sex, the Japanese army started a worldwide sex trafficking circuit during World War II. Like I mentioned in this episode, rape, it's embedded into the Japanese army. So wherever the Japanese army was, they would just grab women. And if they would grab a woman, fucking send these women, send them over there because those guys don't have enough women. So they're just capturing women and just sending them to all over parts of the world. And when the war ended and all this came to light, they were like, we had no idea. What the fuck? What's going on? What? And then we had all these papers signed off by military generals and high ranking officers and everybody saying, yup, 3 trailers worth of women. Cool. Sign it off. Send them over here. So there's like little things. I don't want to say little things, but things in the book that we're not covering that kind of paints this more picture, more horrible than fucking what we're making it out to be. So again, the rape of Nanking, the forgotten Holocaust of World War II. Thank you guys. And as always, if nobody has anything else to add.
Nope.
We are the Weird History Eerie Tales Pod.